Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Mark Reardon. Scott Jennings is a regular contributor to my show on KMOX as a political analyst. He does it for a lot cheaper than his regular stint on CNN. That's not because of me. Jennings is a huge Cardinals fan. He grew up in Western Kentucky listening to games on KMOX. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush and served as deputy White House political director. Today on Profiles, political analyst and guru, Scott Jennings.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Scott Jennings is with me on KMOX Profiles. How are you, Jennings?
Hey, Mark. Good to be with you. I'm doing great.
I thought this would be a fun one to do because you and I have really gotten to know each other over the course of the past couple of years, and we should point out that there is a mutual friend. We should also point out from the get-go here, one of the connections with Scott, not only is he very insightful on politics, but and this is an important part of contributing to my show. He's a huge Cardinals fan, and we'll talk a little baseball as we go on. But there's a guy named Joe Arnold who used to work at WHAS Radio in Louisville, Kentucky, and I got to know Joe over the years, and Scott Jennings. I used to listen to you do news in like the middle of the night on that radio station many moons ago.
That's a true story. When I was in college at the University of Louisville, I had a job doing the news for WHAS, and one of my shifts was midnight to 6 a.m. And so they had Joe Arnold on doing his talk show, and I'm at the top and bottom of each hour. And of course, with a station like that and like this one, in the middle of the night, you can reach a lot of the country. And so We had a great show, and Joe was a great radio guy, and we've become lifelong friends after that overnight experience together.
Yeah, and he hooked me up with you because he knew how connected you are with politics, and you've been really, really awesome and very generous with your time here on KMOX, and we got to go to all three of us went to a Cardinals game last year. We'll talk revisit baseball here in a moment. Let's do a little This Is Your Life here with Scott Jennings and what happened before you were at WHAS, and we'll get into the afterwards. Where'd you grow up, just right there in the Louisville area?
No, actually, I grew up in the zone of influence of KMOX. I grew up in far western Kentucky in a little town called Dawson Springs, and that's why I'm a Cardinals fan and sort of feel a pull to St. Louis, because I grew up down there in the far western end of the state. In fact, our summer vacation every summer was my dad would put us all in the car and drive us to St. Louis, and we'd catch a series, you know, in some hot summer weekend there at the old Busch Stadium. So I'm a proud rural Western Kentuckian and have been a Cardinal fan my entire life, really because of the proximity to the town and because of the being able to hear it on the radio at night.
Wasn't there a TV show Dawson's Creek, Dawson Springs? It was Dawson Springs, wasn't it?
It was Dawson's Creek, and they had a slightly different upbringing than I had in Dawson Springs.
Yes, I think that is. So what were you, you know, because of the radio thing, were you fascinated with media? Is that what you wanted to do, or was it always politics?
No, it was always media, actually. Growing up, I knew I wanted to be on the radio. I loved radio. In fact, when I was 16 years old, my first job was as a radio disc jockey on a couple of small country music stations. So I was in high school, and I was doing the country music DJ work. I was, you know, these stations are so small. You know, you're also the news guy, the weather guy, the sports guy, the person who reads the obituaries on Sunday morning. You're also recording commercial copies. So you did all these jobs. And I loved it, and that's why I did it when I was in college. I thought I was going to be a broadcaster and a journalist. But in 2000, all that changed when Senate Majority Leader, then Senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, calls me up on the phone and says, when are you going to get off the sidelines and get into the game? And he was recruiting me to get into politics. So I left all of my media and all of my journalism behind and went to work for a governor, Texas Governor George W. Bush.
So, you know, I want to get to that in a second, but with Mitch McConnell, you you have great insight when it comes to analyzing politics, which is one of the reasons that I like you so much. And you're on CNN as a contributor, and it seems to come so naturally to you. So was that something that Mitch McConnell saw in you? So you had this ability to figure out strategy and understand politics, or was he just taking a flyer to a certain extent?
Well, I had been part of McConnell's orbit for several years. I was a McConnell scholar at the University of Louisville. He has a center, a scholarship that provides full rides to U of L for 10 Kentucky students per year that have an interest in public service and politics. I was fortunate enough to win one of those scholarships when I went off to college. So I'd known him for a few years. And I had obviously told him over the years how interested I was in public affairs and politics and his career. I come from a family that's been politically involved in Western Kentucky. My grandfather was a local elected official. My dad was on the city council. Now, of course, they were all Democrats. I grew up in a big Democratic mm-hmm. household, and my earliest memories of politics are of riding around with Democrat politicians. So it's been in my blood a little bit. It was certainly developed in the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville and then ultimately turned into a career.
What do you remember about the first time you met George W. Bush?
Well, gosh, the first time I met him, I guess, would have been during the 2000 campaign, I guess. It would have been on one of his visits to Kentucky. In fact, I believe he did a little bit of a bus tour through Kentucky. You know, it's interesting. You meet these people in politics and they just have it. It's not measurable. You can't quantify it, but you can tell the people that have it and the people that don't. And Bush just had it. He walked into a room. He captivated the room. People liked him. He really had those intangible qualities that make for strong presidential candidates. And it's not partisan. You know, it's just a sort of a magnetism that most people who win have. And so I remember how natural he felt on the campaign trail. I remember how well he was able to connect with rural Kentuckians in that 2000 campaign. And, of course, back in those days, Kentucky was thought of as a Democrat state. Bill Clinton had won it twice, and so it was thought of as a target state. Of course, now it's a Republican stronghold, but back in those days, I remember thinking, I picked the right campaign. For my first one, I picked the right campaign.
I would say, you know, I met George W. Bush for the first time on the roof of Churchill Downs, which I'm guessing would have been in 2000, because he was up there as Texas governor, so I'll never forget that. He was, and, you know, we've probably even talked about this in the past, and anyone who has met George W. Bush, I think, would say the same thing. He's kind of a different guy in person. He does have that, you know, charm about him. And then for whatever reason, this happens with some folks in politics. The cameras go on and it's a little different. But for people who had that direct contact with George W. Bush, I think they always came away feeling real positive about that.
Yeah, it's one of the things I admired about him the most, that he was the same in private as he was in public. His personality never changed. I always found him to be an extraordinarily decent and civil person, a very honest person. And contrary to the way the media portrayed him, you know, I went on to work in his White House and spent, you know, some amount of time in the Oval Office around him. But contrary to the portrayals of him, I found him to be extraordinarily intelligent, handling multiple things at a time, you know, quickly moving from subject to subject. The media, I think, really did him a disservice in the way they portrayed him and, frankly, Vice President Cheney as well. I think that they were much different people than the way the media portrayed them and the way they wanted people to see them. And so I was glad I was able to see them up close and personal and understand who they really are in a way that I never thought he got a fair shake in how smart he was, how quick he was, and just how in touch with the American people he was, the way he was covered in his campaigns and during his administration.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Scott Jennings, my guest on KMOX Profiles. He's a regular political contributor to my show, served in key roles in both of President Bush's campaigns in 2000, 2004, became special assistant to the president and deputy White House political director in 2005. So, Scott, let's go back to that time. How you'd been working in the White House, you had this relationship with George W. Bush. What did those roles entail?
Well, coming out of the 2004 campaign where I ran New Mexico for the president, and we flipped that state from blue to red, it was one of only two states. I had struck up a relationship with Karl Rove, who was obviously the president's political strategist. And so because of that, because of my work on the campaign, I got to go to work in the Office of Political Affairs. And we had a very broad portfolio. We handled the president's domestic travel, which is a lot of planning to move around a president. I also had a heavy hand in the personnel process, vetting people for administration appointments. The president gets to appoint a huge number of people, all the way from Supreme Court justice to cabinet secretaries, a lot of boards and commissions, a lot of positions throughout the government. So one of the things I worked on the most, frankly, was finding people from around the country who wanted to come to government, who wanted to come into public service, and finding those folks, getting them cleared, and making sure they were sufficiently supportive of the president's agenda so that when they took these jobs, they could enact what his views were in the particular area that they were coming to work in.
You had a role in the confirmation process of two Supreme Court justices, didn't you? John Roberts and Samuel Alito.
I did, actually three, two successful and one aborted, Harriet Myers. didn't last very long, but that was another one that happened on our watch. But yes, Roberts and Alito, people forget these were big battles. We think of the court battles that go on today with Trump and the Democrats, but there were big court battles back then, and this kind of kicked off sort of this acrimony over judicial appointments. But Democrats raged against Roberts and Alito, and we had to run a campaign to get them confirmed, and we did, and thank goodness we did. But from that point forward, you know, we've just seen the acrimony increase between the parties over judicial appointments. These things used to be relatively non-controversial, but those were certainly controversial. And so a big part of my job during the 3 years I was there was to work on those confirmations and try to make the senators in the target states see it our way. And fortunately, we did.
So I've been to the White House. I've never been in the Oval Office. And I can't imagine that if I was in the Oval Office, I wouldn't be just completely distracted that I'm in the Oval Office. And you're there spending time and sometimes in some high profile meetings. That had to be very surreal.
It was. I never walked in when I didn't sort of stop and feel that chill, you know, that you get when you sort of walk into a place and you can't help but take a moment, a beat, to think of all the things that have happened in this room, to think of all the people who've been in here and all the monumental and momentous decisions that have been made. And here I am, some, you know, guy from small town Western Kentucky, and I get to walk in here and play a very, very small part of this. It gave me a chill. And in fact, it gives me a chill just talking about it with you today. One of my bosses when I started was Andy Carr, who was White House Chief of Staff. And I asked him, I said, how do you know when it's time to leave a job like this? Because I can't imagine ever wanting to leave. And he said, you know, one of the things you should always remember is if when you walk in this building, if you don't stop every day and stand in awe of this building, then you know it's time to depart. And I sort of carried that advice around thinking, I guess there are some people who ultimately take it for granted, but I never did. I walked in every day and felt a chill and a shudder. Just because of what it represents, not just to our country, but to the world. The White House is the epicenter of the world, and to be in the middle of it was a privilege.
So what did you do after 2008? You ran some or were involved in some races, including Mitch McConnell's race in 2008, weren't you?
I was. Yeah, I went home to Kentucky. My wife and I decided to move home, and we started our family. So I started having kids and went into the private sector. I started doing public affairs and public relations consulting. And I was still politically involved. I worked on Mitch McConnell's 08 campaign. I ran a congressional campaign in Kentucky for a guy who's still in and whose campaigns I still run today, Congressman Brett Guthrie. I ultimately worked on Mitt Romney's campaign. I helped Jeb Bush early in the primary in 2016. I've done a lot of races around the country and a lot of different political organizations. I've gotten into the super PAC and independent expenditure world as well. So my career post-White House has been a mix of corporate consulting, crisis communications work, media work, political consulting, and of course now it's morphed into this role with CNN, and I write a regular column for Gannett, Courier Journal, and USA Today. So I'm fortunate. I get to do a lot of different things, which makes every day fresh and new.
How did the CNN role come about?
Well, in 2016, I was not working on the Trump campaign, and I had a contact who knew Britt Hume, who had just taken over for Greta Van Susteren at Fox News around Labor Day. And because I wasn't working on the campaign, they thought maybe I'd be a good analyst. So I wound up being a polling analyst on Fox News for Brett Hume's show throughout the 2016 election. So I was on Fox actually mostly from 2016 through early 2017. And then I got a call in May of 2017 from CNN asking me if I'd like to come and be part of a show. I said yes. So I went up and did Anderson Cooper's show for a couple of nights. And you know, really, a few days later, I got offered a contract to be an exclusive contributor. I've been with CNN since June of 2017, and I've loved every minute of it. Being part of the conversation is also a real privilege. And
well,
I've been on the air for a lot of big stories.
Well, and I think it's an important role that you have. And Doug High, who's another one of our contributors here, because you guys on CNN are sometimes the only sane commentary that we hear. But you have to, just knowing the climate, do you take grief for doing the stuff on CNN from other Republicans?
Sure. I mean, I've had Republicans come up to me and say, you know, you shouldn't be part of that. But honestly, I don't really subscribe to that thinking. I think we need a robust public affairs conversation in this country. That means Fox is valuable. MSNBC is valuable. CNN is valuable. I think we need more people talking about our national political affairs. And frankly, CNN's willingness to have both liberals and conservatives have these conversations at the same time and not buy into one side or the other, I really appreciate. And so I tell all my Republican friends, would you rather me be on CNN and the marketplace of ideas battling it out for what we believe in? Or would you rather me just be one of a hundred voices saying the same thing on another network? So I like the role I have, and I think CNN cultivates these conversations, and it's meaningful and it's valuable.
Yeah, well, I like it too, because both, you know, I mentioned Doug too. You guys bring, look, there's smart political savvy that you bring to the table, and you know, maybe you have to give CNN a little credit, because if they wanted to, they could just put someone on there, and I think they have in the past, that's just a little crazy and over the edge. But that doesn't really do us any good when it comes to actually analyzing and having serious political conversations in this country, which seemingly are more difficult to have every day, each and every day.
Yeah, they're trying to, in some ways, model better civil discourse when they put people together. And sometimes, you know, it falls short. I mean, we all fall short in getting it right every single time. I certainly looked back on a couple of panels and thought, well, I shouldn't have gotten so emotional about a point. But I try to bring my experience and my values and my personal views and apply them all. And I try not to die on every hill. You know, I think this is where pundits fall short. When you're willing to die on every hill, then you lose all credibility. And I'm willing to criticize the president when I think he needs it. I'm willing to stand up for him when I think he deserves it, even when everybody else is raging against him. But I think you have to be able to have enough credibility to understand that no human being who's in politics is right all of the time, and no human being is wrong all of the time. And the people who treat it that way, I think, do a disservice to their own credibility.
Scott Jennings is my guest on KMOX Profiles. We all have these impressions of people we see on TV, whether it's Anderson Cooper or Britt Hume, and, you know, you make your judgment call. Were there people that you ended up working with on the air, meeting, that you maybe were surprised in the end that you became friends with or just had a different opinion of, just out of curiosity?
Well, I've met quite a few Democrats who sort of are in my general line of work on CNN, and I have become good friends with several of them. There's a commentator on CNN named Simone Sanders, who's a Democrat political operative, very liberal. You know, she and I don't agree on anything politically, but we've become really good buddies, and had a stint at Harvard together where we were both fellows in the Institute of Politics, and she's someone that I would never have imagined being friends with, but am. Another person who I share an office with at Harvard, who I now teach a class with and also did work on CNN with, is Robbie Mook, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager in 2016. Again, somebody you'd never imagine that you'd become buddies with. But Robbie is a great guy, and we have shared a wonderful experience together teaching this class on modern American political campaigns at the Harvard Kennedy School. But this is what has been so much fun about this media engagement is, if not for CNN and not for doing this, I wouldn't have met some of these folks, and I wouldn't have become friends with them, and I wouldn't have had these reminders that, hey, yeah, we all have our points of view, but we're all Americans and we're all in this together. And that's what I think these relationships are good for.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to KMOX Profiles. Scott Jennings is my guest. He's a regular political contributor to my show. You see him on CNN all the time. He's got a company in Louisville called Run Switch PR. Scott, before the break, you were talking about Harvard and teaching that class, and I'm fascinated. We went to Busch Stadium last year, and you were kind of filling me in about this. I was unaware of Professor Jennings and the role that you had, and you're teaching this class right now with Robbie Mook. So how challenging is that? And I'm just curious, because you've worked in politics now for so long. The dynamics have shifted dramatically certainly in the last 15, 20 years, but even more so in the last 5 years.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it is interesting to try to teach a class when so much has changed about the way we campaign in America. So our class is a mixture of the way we used to do it, the way things work today, and also we run a simulation in the class where we put our students on different campaign teams and we give them scenarios to which they have to respond. And so we also bring in a lot of special guest lecturers and people from the business who can give them some good insights on how things are done. So we try to make it real practical, and we try to use real world, real life lessons to which they can apply the practical things they're learning from us. So we sort of designed this course from scratch, and we think we had a really good idea, and it worked out well. We thought we were going to have about 50 students, but we had a huge amount of signups, and we ended up having over 120 students take the class, which meant I had to grade a lot more papers than I had bargained for.
Was there one person out of the 120 that leaned to the right at all, just out of curiosity?
Actually, we did survey the class, and about 80% of the class identified as Democratic or liberal. About 16% of the class identified as conservative, and the rest identified as something else. So there were a few conservatives in there, and I was glad to have them. And frankly, I was glad to have all the students. Honestly, I've done two tours of duty at Harvard's Kennedy School now. And yeah, most folks on campus are not of my political persuasion, but I have been treated extraordinarily well by the faculty, the administration, the students. It's actually a pretty fun place to be. And they've given me a chance to take part in it. And I'm grateful for that, because I think we do need to have more ideological balance on college campuses so that we can all, you know, understand the points of view from where we're coming. This is the way we'll heal the divides in this country, is by having conversations, by understanding points of view, understanding our backgrounds. If we sort of wall ourselves off from each other, these divides that have marked our politics will never get any better. So good job to Harvard for trying to make that a reality at the Kennedy School.
I want you to get into a little bit of how these campaigns are changing from this perspective with technology. And look, I'm in AM radio, and we know how much has changed with media. But when it comes to campaigns, I hear more and more. I had a chance to, I know the former speaker, Paul Ryan, pretty well, and at a dinner event last year in St. Louis, talking about, and obviously things did not work out as well as Paul had hoped for re-election and keeping the majority in the House. But he talked a lot about just how campaigns are micro-targeting voters out there. You can't just assume that television ads or radio ads or even billboards or some of those things are going to work anymore. And you really dial down specifically on different demographics and different people. And a lot of people don't know how that works. Is there any light that you can shed on that without giving away too many political secrets?
Sure. We covered this a lot in our class. And, you and I could do a two-hour show on this because there's so much to talk about. But you know, when I got into politics back in 2000, it was mostly just geographic-based targeting. If you lived in a specific precinct that it performed a certain way, you'd get a lot of attention. But in 2004, the Bush campaign actually was the first to kind of model what we now call micro-targeting, where instead of looking at where people lived, we started looking at their characteristics, how they were registered, yes, but also their consumer habits, the things that they like to do, the magazines they subscribe to, the sorts of choices they made in their lives. And we started to use those characteristics to identify people that might want to vote for a specific candidate that wouldn't look obvious based on where they lived or how they were registered to vote. This kind of thinking has evolved over the years. It took a giant leap forward with the Obama folks. They really moved it forward. And now I think the Republican Party has swung back and has a really good data operation. But basically, it's built on knowing things about people. And people, I think, would be shocked to find out just how much the political operatives and the consultants now know about every individual voter. And so you start to try to put together what we call models, and you do predicted voter scores. So I can look at a whole data set of voters, and based on all of your characteristics, I can determine a prediction on how many votes I could expect to get out of that data set. That is a vast departure from how it worked when I got into this business in 2000. And it's all based on how much we know about every individual. I think people will be stunned to find out just how much we know about you.
You know, the example that was offered to me was, we could possibly know that Mark Reardon is downstairs watching Cardinals baseball, for example, and Rebecca Reardon, my wife, is upstairs watching Top Chef. You know, sometimes you can dial it down to really, really getting specific, and it's sort of fascinating. You know what's sad, though, still, to this day? We had recently, Scott, an election for the Board of Aldermen president in St. Louis, and, you know, the city has dwindled in population, 350,000, 335,000, whatever the number is, but the amount of people who actually participated in a very important election is just paltry. And, you know, we see this participation even in presidential elections where, for whatever reason, I've had guests on my show, you know, people who've called in, try to explain why they don't vote. But we're not going to get anything solved in this country if more people don't start paying attention, are we?
Well, actually, I think that we are seeing greater interest in our national politics than we have had over the last, you know, 2 to 3 decades. I mean, who knew all we needed to fix American democracy was Donald Trump? I mean, if you look at the 2018 midterm, turnout was higher for the midterm than it had been for any midterm in 100 years. I think in the 2020 presidential, we're going to see a huge spike in what you would expect the turnout to be. And so I do think we're seeing greater participation. And to go back to a point you made about watching television and being able to differentiate between people in a household, some of it may be due to the fact that we can differentiate. It's true. We can identify what you're watching versus what your wife is watching with set-top box data. And that really does make a difference in the kind of advertising we'll buy for a specific media market or a specific state. And because we're able to now better target the advertising, it may in fact be leading to greater voter engagement because they're actually seeing advertising that is more meaningful to them than they perhaps used to see. So I think a combination of just the political state of affairs plus improvements in how we advertise to voters may actually be leading to greater voter engagement. Now, we're never going to have a voter turnout the way they have in some countries that have compulsory voting where they fine you if you don't participate. But I actually think it's going up right now, and it's going up across a lot of different places and a lot of different cohorts, age especially. So that's a good thing. We do need more people to participate, and that'll be healthy for our democracy.
Scott Jennings, my guest on KMOX Profiles. What is the state of conservatism? So I became a conservative in the early 1980s. I'm a little older than you are. Ronald Reagan, of course, was in office, and I've always believed in small, limited government, been concerned about government recklessly spending, all of these things that were in the past conservative principles. Donald Trump comes along. I took a stand against him in 2016. I was one of those never Trumpers because I didn't believe that he was a conservative. I thought he favored more liberal positions on a lot of issues. Now, he's changed my mind to a certain extent on that, but I do think we've muddied the waters just a little bit with people who have seemingly, when I say people, constituencies, large groups of Republican voters who have seemingly insisted on certain things for decades, including the issue of character counting, that's all been kind of flushed down the toilet. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I do think he has scrambled how we have traditionally thought of the two parties and how we've thought of, you know, conservative versus liberals. He wasn't a traditional Republican and he didn't run in some ways as a traditional Republican. Now, 90% of everything he's done, from judges to regulations to taxes, has all been what you would expect any normal Republican president to do. What sets him apart, of course, is attitude. You know, his attitude about the way things should work in Washington, his attitude towards the media, his attitude towards his political opponents, his attitude about certain world events is a drastic departure from what you would expect a Republican president to do, or any president for that matter. But then again, that's what people voted for. In 2016, they rejected business as usual. They rejected the elites. They rejected, you know, sort of the politician class. And they just went with somebody who was sort of the antithesis to all of that. And I think, frankly, that's exactly what they're getting. So you can love it or you can hate it. But what people were voting for in that election, I think, had less to do with policy and more to do with attitude.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Trump has certainly been he's been true to that, really. I mean, if that's the central animation of his campaign, I mean, it'd be hard to say he hasn't been true to that. He promised it and he's delivered it.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back. Scott Jennings, my guest on KMOX Profiles. He's a regular political contributor to my show on KMOX, also on CNN. I think he gets paid a little bit better on CNN, but I appreciate everything that he does for me. So we're recording this profile in the spring of 2019. I want to bring that up because, you know, certainly throughout the course of the year, whenever folks might be listening to this, there will be some things that have changed. But let's talk about 2020, Scott, and expectations there, because what we're seeing, at least at this point, is a big field for the Democrats and a lot of folks drifting way over, I mean like way over to the left. And we know Republicans have to do this to win in Iowa and early primary states as well. But the one thing that is a little confusing, and you're a political strategist, does your buddy Robbie Mook and the rest of the Democrats out there, don't they get how that's going to affect folks in Kentucky and Missouri and Indiana and maybe Pennsylvania and Wisconsin? Are they just not expecting that folks in working class states and blue collar voters, maybe those people who voted for Democrats for a long time that switched and voted for Donald Trump, aren't going to react negatively to that?
Well, it's a good question, because I think the party strategists for the Democrats and a lot of their leadership understand the perils of going too far outside of the mainstream. Unfortunately for them, or fortunately for Republicans, the party energy, the heart and soul of their party, really is more in the Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, you know, wing of the party. So their activists, their donors, the energy, the heart and soul of the Democrats is pretty far to the left and pretty far outside the mainstream. This, of course, has the party strategist very nervous, but you can't really hold it back. It's a little bit like, I think, the Republican energy in 2010. You know, they had a rejection of Obama in the 2010 midterm, the Tea Party rise and the Republicans. All the energy was on the far right. And of course, that manifested itself in Barack Obama getting reelected. and so now we have sort of the shoe on the other foot, where you've got a lot of energy on the left, way on the left, and an incumbent president who, frankly, is doing all the things you would expect an incumbent president to do, to wield the tools that the White House gives you to run an effective reelection campaign. I see a lot of similarities, Mark, between 2012 and 2020. Obama was able to define Mitt Romney and the Republicans early on, before Romney could ever really get off the ground. And I see Trump doing the same thing to the Democrats this time around.
Do you have, we'll see how this works out, because, you know, I told you before we recorded this that, you know, these air a couple of times. Do you have, if you had to pick three, let's just say three Democrat candidates who have the best chance, who would they be?
Well, I think they all have interesting facets to their personalities that would make them intriguing nominees. I put them into two buckets. One is sort of the optimistic bucket of the future, and the other is sort of the negative, you know, dark populist bucket. So Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, really running, you know, sort of angry, negative campaigns. Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, running more positive, you know, forward-looking campaigns. I tend to think Joe Biden tries to float above it all. So I think Biden would present some problems for President Trump. I think Kamala Harris is an interesting choice, because she's an antithesis to everything Trump is. And then finally, I look at a wild card person, maybe somebody that isn't as well known, like an Amy Klobuchar, who has performed pretty well in the Midwestern United States and won some races with margins in rural areas that you wouldn't expect Democrats to win in. So I'd say those three right now are at the top of my list. But honestly, it's a wide open field. I think the Democrats right now are really going through this internal struggle over, should we nominate someone who gives us a chance to win? Or should we not, like Biden say, or should we nominate someone who really matches where our heart is, like Bernie Sanders? And that right there is going to determine a lot about how Trump runs his reelection campaign. I think, frankly, he's doing the right thing right now, trying to define all of them the same way. No, it doesn't matter who they nominate. They're all going to be socialists. They're all going to be out of the mainstream. That's the correct tactic. We'll see if their nominee plays into Trump's hands.
So we have to close this profile on a baseball note, because you're a huge Cardinals fan growing up in Kentucky, as you mentioned earlier in the show, you know, listening to KMOX, and you and I got to know each other through another Cardinals fan, Joe Arnold, who is from Belleville. And it's just really special to be part of Cardinals Nation, isn't it? I know a lot of the folks who grew up where you did feel very, very connected with St. Louis because of those summer vacations they used to take along the lines of your family, Scott.
I have been a Cardinals fan since I can remember picking up a baseball as a young boy. And coming to St. Louis was always special. Meeting people connected with the organization was always special. I've got a framed picture of myself and Ozzie Smith and a signed Ozzie Smith bat hanging up in my house. My favorite player growing up was Jack Clark, Jack the Ripper, you know, a first baseman for a couple of years. He was the first baseman when I was a young little leaguer. And so I have followed this team. My emotional state is heavily dependent upon what happened last night
right.
in the game. And honestly, you know, for my dad and me, when I was growing up, my dad was a man of few words. And we didn't have a ton in common always, but one thing we always had in common was Cardinal baseball. No matter what was going on, we always had something to talk about, and it was Cardinal baseball. And so now I'm trying to pass that on to my four boys. I have four young boys, ages 10, 5, 3, and 1, and I want them all to be Cardinal fans because I know what the team and the tradition meant to the relationship for my dad and for me, and I sort of want to recreate that for my children. That's the greatness of baseball, and the Cardinal Nation is, I think, you know, the best of baseball, and the way it builds these relationships inside of families and among the fan base, you know, over generations. So it's an honor to walk into that stadium, and I believe that every time I've ever bought a ticket or ever been to a game with you or anyone else. It's an honor to be part of it.
You want your kids to be Cardinals fans. It sounds like you're starting your own farm club.
I know. And I've got one good baseball player. He's a catcher. My oldest son, Everett, is catching. Although, unfortunately, he was placed for this Little League season on the Reds in his league in Oldham County, Kentucky. And so I'm having to explain to him that being on the Reds Little League team doesn't mean we're not Cardinals fans at home. So just I got to get that straight with him, and I have to remind him several times a day.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.